Well, welcome to yet another episode of the Delta Flyers. And this week we have one of our guests that we've had in the past multiple times. So we want to thank Lisa Klink for coming and joining us yet again on the Delta Flyers. Hi, Lisa. Thank you for your time.
Hey, Lisa, thanks for having me.
Great to see you.
And congrats, first of all, for the fact that the Writers Guild has come to a settlement now. So that is a wonderful thing.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
How well-versed are you in all the points of contention that the Writers Guild brought up in their strike?
Reasonably well-versed. I mean, I looked at the memo of the agreement, but I haven't read the whole seven-page thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And what were the main points of contention? I mean, can you like just brush through those?
A lot of it was, of course, is money. Minimum payments, went up, and residuals were another big thing because, of course, that's what carries us through all that time of unemployment.
Right.
And with the streamers in particular, we had trouble with residuals because they weren't sharing their data about viewership.
Mm.
Yep. And so unless you know how many people are watching something, you can't calculate residuals.
That's true.
So we worked out a kind of a compromise in which I believe they're going to tell the Writers Guild about their viewership numbers, but not individual members.
Okay.
So the Writers Guild should be able to calculate what we should get.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what I had read in the summary of the deal. It was like all of the AMPTP streamers agreed that they will share that proprietary data, but that it has to be kept super secret. And it's a whole thing.
Somebody at the guild gets this information, but none of the individual writers will get this information.
It's not public information. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Got it.
It's so funny because I heard this great podcast. I forget whose it was about. It was talking about the Nielsen ratings and how they came about. And it started with radio, although it really exploded with television, but it started with radio. And the guy Nielsen out of Chicago, he had been like he had failed at so many businesses and then came up with this idea. He's like, hey, I bet all the people that advertise on radio would love to know, like, how many people are listening to that radio show. And then they'll know if they're overpaying or it'll be valuable information. So he started this idea of like Nielsen families where they have a box.
Yeah.
And they would willingly, they'd get paid a little money to give all this information of what they were watching and check in and how old were the people in the room? Were they under 18 or all that information?
Yeah.
And that, anyway, the Nielsen ratings were so powerfully profound. Like,
they really were.
Drove the business in so many ways, and box office. Like, people, I remember those were published numbers. Like, you could see in the paper, the top 100 shows, the rankings, the Nielsen rankings. But everybody had that.
My issue with the Nielsen ratings this whole time is that it is a select portion. It's a small sampling of people that they hand these boxes out to. It's not a box given to every TV that's sold in the world or America.
No, it's not every TV. Yeah. No. But you can extrapolate. Like, you can
really believe? I mean, okay.
Yes, I do. Okay. I think that if you have enough a big enough sample.
Yeah.
It's kind of like saying, cigarettes give you cancer. Like, do we need to actually have every person smoke to know
No, we don't. I just like an accurate count of being watched. That's all.
Yeah, it probably could have been more precise and probably didn't take in to account all kinds of variables.
Let's say it's 10,000 households. What if those 10,000 households don't like the franchise that we were in? All right. You see what I'm saying? Or what if those 10,000 that were chosen are all rabid fans of the franchise we were in? Then all of a sudden now our show is the number one show in the country. That's why I don't like that. So it's just
More the concern is, what if all 10,000 people are all white families, or what happens if
exactly.
All, immigrant families or, that's more, I think, what my concern would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. My concern would be the same. It's the demographics. Are we representing culturally the same kinds of percentages or, you know, statistically, is it equivalent to the larger, the greater population? But
right.
But anyway, there's nothing like that with streamers.
And we really, really need it.
Yeah.
I mean, right now we're relying on the streamers to self-report.
Yeah.
You know, but see, that's not fair either, though, isn't it? They can still fudge those numbers.
Of course they can.
They're saying that, trust us, we'll tell you how many times it's been watched. And that's them. How do you police that? There's nobody policing that. That's
my issue. I don't understand, though, how, like, if Nielsen could come up with this idea of putting a box on top of a radio or a TV that you pressed a button and you did.
Right.
If they could come up with that idea, why can't they put a box on 500,000 computers or an app? It doesn't even have to be a physical box. It could be like, download the Nielsen app and you participate. And then all of your viewing through the streamers is recorded. And then the Nielsens are what tell us. What just like they used to do in the old
days. Should pitch that idea to Nielsen yourself, Robbie.
Go
make some money out of what you just said. That's a great idea.
Well, I think we should do it as the Delta Flyers. It should be an app that we
come up with that we hand over to Nielsen.
I don't want
to
give this to the Nielsen.
That's true. We don't want to give it. Yeah, we have to come up with our own app.
But don't you think Netflix knows perfectly well how many people are watching their shows?
Oh, heck yeah.
You know, like Amazon Prime. I mean, they know.
They know every number. They know all of it.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, other points of contention.
Another point of contention that I'm really happy about for TV writers is that they now have a minimum size writing room.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Because especially with the streamers, the number of orders have really been shrinking. And so, you know, we used to do 26 episodes a season. Now they do 8 or 10.
Right.
And what they'll do is they'll have like, you know, 2 or 3 writers in a mini writer's room. They'll write all the episodes and then the writers will go home.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll get into production. And that's, you know, obviously that's really reducing the number of jobs that are just available to writers.
Sure. Yeah.
And so now they have minimums that, you know, if a series has like 6 episodes, they need to have 3 writers, and 10 episodes, they need to have 5 writers, that kind of thing.
Okay. Got it.
And I think that's really necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes it more fair, right? I mean, they were taking advantage of the system beforehand.
They were. And I mean, what we didn't win, what is still a concern, is that the writers don't have any production experience. They don't get to stay through production. You know, they don't go to production meetings. They don't go to the set. They don't go to casting, nothing like that.
They're not allowed to? Is that what you're saying? What do you
mean? Pretty much.
Okay.
I mean, they certainly are not still employed and able to be able to do so.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah. What we did on the show that I work on, because the writing staff was all wrapped pretty much by the time we started filming the first episode.
Wow.
So we saved some money in the writer's budget, saved some weeks in there to bring up the more junior writers. Even if they weren't actively producing, they were on set for at least, I think we wanted to give them at least 2 weeks of production time, and didn't always line up with a production meeting and filming. Sometimes they'd come day two of filming. Sometimes they come, you know, a couple days, because we tried to do it Monday through Friday for a 2 week span, but we did try to get them up. But that was all us. That was all us trying to be creative to make sure that these writers were participating in the production and learning how to produce on set, how to talk with directors, how to give notes, how to let go of some ideas and kind of go with what's happening and all of that. It's, there's a lot to learn there. So,
and it's crucial, because these are the people who are going to be running shows.
Yeah.
You know, in what, 5-10 years.
Yeah.
So right now we're not training anybody to be able to do that.
Right. Yeah. It reminds me of that sci-fi show that we all worked on together.
Yes.
The space show. Because you were currently employed pretty much all through the year.
We had like 3 weeks off a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were able to come to set, even though I don't think that particular show at that time, it didn't encourage writers on set. Like the bosses there did not encourage participation. It was sort of deliver the pages and wait until the cut comes in to be angry.
But we did go to production meetings and we went to casting.
That's true. That's true.
And we were, you know, allowed to go down to set. I mean, they didn't actually chase us out.
Right. No, I loved when you guys, we all loved
nice
when
you
guys
came
down.
We were happy to see you. We were
so
like,
happy.
They're here. writers.
The resource of having the brains that were in the rooms when all those different possibilities were debated and decided on. Because sometimes on set, you'll go, oh, I know. The great solution is that he should be screaming this in this moment because it's the angry thing.
Yeah.
And then if the writer's there, the writer can say, oh, you know what? It's not on the page, but we did talk about that. And we really don't want to do the screaming thing. That was debated and discussed.
Yeah.
We want to do this, you know. So there's some things that aren't crystal clear in the writing, as hard as writers work to make it crystal clear.
Yeah,
that having that writer's brain, the experience of being in through the process of all the ideas being debated and some ideas being discarded, it helps a lot.
It's more efficient. You get the job done faster,
because you know what
they want.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. Totally. All right. Any other things noteworthy-wise?
Another big thing that is, I think, just even more important for the actors is the AI situation.
Yeah. Okay. How does that affect the writers, the AI situation?
Well, what we're concerned that the studios are going to do is use an AI, you know, ChatGPT or whatever the new thing is, to generate, you know, the crappy version of a script.
Gotcha.
You know, the bad first draft.
Yeah.
And then they'll hire an actual human writer to come in and rewrite it. You know, from page one. And they'll only have to pay them the rewrite rate.
Right.
Because it's supposedly it's already existing material.
Right.
And then also the studio will be the author of that material. They'll have the copyright, all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
As opposed to a spec that is actually generated by a human writer.
Okay.
So that's what we're really afraid of, is that they're going to try and basically do as much of the writing, you know, or what they consider writing on their end of it.
Well, did you guys argue for the rewrite to be paid higher, to be paid more? You know what I'm saying?
What we came to is that for screenplays, the writer does get first pass at the rewrite.
Okay.
So like if I sold a spec tomorrow, I would be contractually obligated to do the first rewrite.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. More specifically than that, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of talk about, you know, they'll have to consult the writer and they'll have to, you know, make things clear to the writer and inform them and all that. But whether that means that they can go ahead and do it anyway, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think the language that the WGA got in this agreement, the language that a script is written by a human.
Yes.
And a writer is a human.
Yes.
That is critical language. It's funny because the Directors Guild, which I've been much more a part of longer, the Directors Guild had some language going way back that described a director as a human person. Mm-hmm. And it was before AI, but it was just legal language because the DGA was always concerned about, in the similar way that writers are concerned about what a writer is, defining what a writer is,
mm-hmm.
and who has ownership of that script. The DGA was concerned about directors defining what is a director. A director is one person, one human person, is I think what the contracts reads.
Yeah.
Taking the responsibility of director in that. So when I'm producing a show, I can't go on and direct the show. I can't even tell the director how to direct the show.
Yeah.
I can give notes. I can ask. My only two options are either let the director direct and interpret my notes however they want, and everyone else's notes, or fire that director. That's it. I don't have the option to say, nope, stop, reblock it a different way, have him come in that door and shoot it from here. I can't do that because there's only one human director. So they had the language in there. So the DGA actually had that language that you can't have AI direct. So it was not necessary for the DGA to specifically call out AI in quite the same way that the writers needed to, because they already had that language. Director's one human person or team.
One thing that they did accomplish is they defined the showrunner as the head writer, as opposed to, you know, some studio executive could declare themselves the showrunner.
Yeah.
But they now are defining that as the head writer and in fact a human person. Yeah. So that's
which is how it was in the old days, right? Okay. All right.
Sort of. I mean, it's interesting. That's a debatable fact because showrunners were often producers. They weren't directors. They weren't writers. They were producers. And they ran the show and they told the writers do this, do that. They told the director, do this, do that. And directors and writers often were very much micromanaged by the showrunner, who was neither a writer or a director. In the old days, if you look at like the Dick Van Dyke Show, there's a great example of the old days. There was, I forget the producer's name, but then there was the writing staff. What has evolved is because the head writer or creator of a show is often got the vision. It's their idea. It's their vision. They hear the voices in their head. They know the style and tone. So it makes sense that the creator slash, you know, head writer, whatever, is the showrunner. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't always the case. But the WGA has taken a very active kind of developmental role in making sure that showrunner is that visionary sort of writer in charge of the script, all those things. They have a showrunner training program at the WGA. There's all mm-hmm. kinds of, that's you're right, Lisa, that's a big step forward, because, you know, the old studios didn't want writers or directors having much power, or actors. No.
Lisa, did you know that Robbie got a writing credit on that show that he produced up in Vancouver? So
I did not know that.
Yeah. So he.
What? Well, more you, than a writing credit.
Are you WGA? Robbie. I've
got my WGA card. He's
a card carrying member.
He's a card carrying member.
Of
now.
Another union I get to pay dues to.
So exciting. Yeah. He got a little help there. And
are you still in SAG?
I am still in SAG. Yeah. I was in AFTRA before they combined. So I was in SAG. Well, first I got in Equity, Actors Equity, the stage union. Then I got in AFTRA. Then I got in SAG. Then the WGA. DGA. DGA. Then I also belong to the UBCP, which is the Canadian actor, the Union of British Columbia Actors, UBCP, and now the Writers Guild. I think that's it. Six union. That's enough.
It's you. You're all gilded out, Robbie. But what'd you say? I know. Sorry.
The Producers Guild is just like a social club, though. They don't really do much of anything.
PGA. Yeah.
I was asked to join a couple times, but I'm like, why don't I want to spend thousands of more dollars on a social club? I don't even live in LA. So.
Yeah. All right. Any other final notes regarding the strike?
On the strike.
On the writer side?
Personally, it was a pretty positive experience, I got to say, being out on the lines.
Great.
Because, you know, working by myself at home, I don't have a lot of interaction with other writers at the moment. And so getting out there and actually being able to talk to people and meet people, especially at the themed pickets. You know, we've had two Star Trek themed pickets. We've had two that were about women in genre. I got to meet a lot of other women who write sci-fi and fantasy and whose work I admired, but I'd never actually met.
Yeah.
So for me, it actually was a pretty positive strike.
That's awesome.
I think it was great for the whole community, the writing and acting community and directors, although, you know, the directors, obviously they made a deal early on. And then, it's funny. I was always thinking back when this first started, I was like, why don't they all just go out together? Like, why don't the directors and everybody, the directors have made a good deal. Like they actually, when I looked at the same sort of back in May, I guess, I looked at the bullet points of all the DGA issues, and they made a lot of progress. It's an excellent deal. It's the same rate increases that the Writers Guild got. It's all kinds of safety issues, which the DGA is very on top of, you know, weapon safety, all kinds of diversity and inclusion issues. I think the DGA has really been strong in that area,
but it is sad that there's no unity, though, Robbie. It's like every union is out for themselves. It's like the DGA, we're gonna deal with our own stuff. The actors, if everyone got together, like you just mentioned, you thought about that in the past. Why can't we have solidarity and unity across the board?
Where it's just like one big union called the Creative Coalition of Hollywood or something, and then each CCH,
I like
it, or something, and then each of the individual specialists can be in charge of their director side or their writing side or their acting side, but it's all or none. You want the creative people involved in your TV and filmmaking, your streamers, all of them, then you got to work with us. I think that would be great.
There you go.
Yeah. Although the actors have really been there for us. I got to say, there were a lot of actors out on the picket lines even before SAG went on strike.
Yeah.
Oh, for the writers and the directors as well, is what you're saying? Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your upbringing and where you're from. I know only one fact about you. You're born in Maryland, correct?
I lived in Maryland.
Oh, so that's incorrect.
Where were you born?
Yeah, where were you
Washington,
born?
Washington, D.C.
In D.C.? What hospital?
George Washington Hospital.
I wonder where my sister was born. My sister was born in Washington, D.C.
Oh.
Yeah.
Really? Robbie, you didn't tell me.
I wonder if you were born at the same hospital. Yeah, 1971, she was born.
71. That's pretty close. That's pretty close. But then you were born in the hospital in D.C., but you were raised in Potomac then or another part of
Well, we actually moved around a lot. So we lived in Maryland for a little while, but then we moved out to San Francisco. Lived there for a few years and then moved down to Woodland Hills here in L.A. and then to South Pasadena in L.A.
I love South Pasadena.
And then back to Potomac, Maryland, which is where I went to high school. So that's where I kind of consider that I'm from.
Same here. I moved around a ton until just before like seventh or eighth grade. And then we settled in Atlanta. So I think of Atlanta as home, even though we lived in D.C. and Gaithersburg, Maryland, and North Carolina, and Philadelphia, and all these places. But
so all the destinations that you were in California were before your high school years.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yes.
So Potomac is where you landed for ninth grade or 10th grade?
Actually, I think sixth grade.
Sixth grade. So even before high school, even before middle school.
High school there.
Okay. Junior high and high school in Potomac, Maryland.
Mm-hmm. I have a question, Lisa. So you moved around, you're in middle school, you're back in Maryland. Did you get into this through acting? I've never asked you that.
Did you do theater?
Did you do plays?
Yeah.
Did you do plays?
Not very prominently though. It's like, I wasn't the lead in all the plays or anything. I usually was in the background people or something.
Yeah.
And I kind of got into the behind the scenes stuff.
Like the crew and building sets and things like that. Lighting.
Yeah, that kind of
stuff.
Okay.
How
stage managing, whatever that kind of.
What was your favorite role?
Yeah, what'd you like play to play?
When you were acting.
Well, I had a lot of fun. We did Anne of Green Gables one year, and I was Miss Stacy, the teacher. Mm. And I got to sing, you know, a solo and all of that, which was, you know, terrifying but fun.
That's amazing. I never knew this. I don't know why it just occurred to me to ask you about that, but that's amazing.
She had the solo. Woo!
I did.
Oh, the future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Okay.
Who was your teacher when you did all of this? Was that someone that who was it? And did they inspire you in some way? Like, do you think that's part of why you pursued writing and screenplays and things?
You know, sadly enough, I do not remember who my teacher was.
Oh,
and it didn't really set me on the Hollywood path.
Okay.
No.
Let me ask you this.
Something I did for fun.
Right. Yeah. When you were in high school or middle school and then high school, what did you think at that point in time your occupation would be? Like, were you thinking, I'm going to be a fill in the blank at that point?
Well, I knew that I liked writing, you know, and I knew that I was probably going to be an English major in college.
Okay.
And so I thought maybe go to law school.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, or maybe end up teaching, maybe journalism. Mm-hmm. There were a couple different things that I looked at, but nothing was really quite the right fit.
Right. But then the point that you think you were bitten by the bug, or at least what was it that put you on the path towards Hollywood? Like, what was the
incident? One specific guest appearance in my film theory class. Duke didn't have a big film department. I mean, there was nothing about production or anything like that. They just had a film theory class.
Right.
So I took that and it was interesting. And they had a producer come out from Hollywood. It was the producer, Tom Mount, who I wasn't familiar with and still am not really, but he brought his latest film to screen for us, Frankenstein Unbound.
Okay.
Dreadful movie. Oh my God, it was terrible. But still, he came and he talked to us. And that was first time that it kind of registered with me that people did this for a living.
Yeah, this is a real job. Okay.
This was a real, actual, honest to God job that like a grown up could do. Okay. And seriously, that's when it dawned on me that this is something I could do.
Right.
And so I decided I was going to become a director.
Ah.
Interesting. Yep. At that point,
film director, film or TV director. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you felt that you could do a way better job than whoever directed that Frankenstein Unbound
project.
Well, that was true. But at the time, I was really James Cameron was really big. You know, Terminator 2 had come out. I really, really loved his work. I was like, I want to do that.
Yeah. Awesome.
I want to go play in that sandbox right there.
Yeah.
So that was pretty much what drove me out to Los Angeles, is that I wanted to go and become the next James Cameron.
Wow. We didn't even
take classes like directing, film TV classes?
I didn't. I did the next best thing. I worked for a director.
Yes.
Oh.
I worked for Catherine Bigelow, actually.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I was her development assistant.
Wow, that is the next best thing then.
Yeah.
What years were you there with Catherine?
With Catherine, it was when the Northridge quake hit.
Okay.
I was working with her then.
94.
You said her house got damaged.
You said Strange Days. Is that what you brought up? That project. Do you know I read for that?
Did you really?
Yes. That's funny.
Do you know that I had a callback for that
role? Wow. And so you met Catherine?
Let's just put it this way. It was for a black market tech dealer guy, right? So I thought I got to be a little shady, you know, for my callback. So I felt like I had to alter my state of consciousness. So I was not even sober at that when I went into that audition, because I thought that's what it called for.
Yeah.
And I remember I was so out of it. I rear-ended someone on the way to the audition.
Oh my God, Garrett. Yep.
Once I got to the audition,
it's called acting.
After I got to the audition and did the audition with, I think it was Catherine that was there. And I said, okay, well, thanks. And I turned around to walk out. I walked into the wall instead of the actual doorway. So that was my one time I realized I can't be like, there's certain actors that can drink a fifth of vodka and they're amazing actors, you know, but I can't be that actor. I have to stay completely sober and not, you know, be messed up and then audition. Cause I thought he's really black market. He's from the underground. He's got to be totally kind of like a tweaker. That's what I thought, you know? And so I totally screwed up my own audition.
Yeah,
that's so weird.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. So question, when you came over to that sci-fi show that we met you on, we all worked on.
Yeah.
Did you talk to them about this directing thing? Like, did you say?
Well, by that time, I wasn't really after directing anymore. Mm. Because when I worked with Catherine, I got to go down to the set and watch her shooting some Strange Days.
Yeah.
And I realized that, no, I do not want to do this.
Okay, oh, wow. Okay. Okay. But how did you get that job to begin with, though? Was that from a friend of a connection?
Well, I started interning, which is, you know, working for free, reading scripts.
Okay.
And then when she hired, you know, a development assistant who actually got paid, she hired me.
Okay. So you were reading scripts for her production company for as an intern to begin with. Yes. Is that what you're saying? Oh.
Yes.
And you were doing your job.
And talk about an education. I was reading all of these scripts from like all the major agencies. Yeah. And most of them were terrible.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just and I found this really encouraging.
So this, that,
like, I could write something that bad.
Yeah.
Did you do like official coverage on that? Did you?
Yes.
Okay. So, because I took a class on coverage at AFI.
Robbie, explain that to people what that means, coverage.
Well, coverage is basically what Lisa did. She read the scripts and then she would give a summary, and there's kind of formats for it. Mm-hmm. Some people just write coverage in their own format, but when I took this class at AFI, it was a brief overview of doing coverage because I was trying to learn how to look at scripts myself in a different way. It was more kind of as an actor and also as a wanting to find projects to develop for myself as a director. So I was looking for some structure on how to do coverage, but yeah, you kind of break it down, you break down the plot and the characters, and then how it's, you give an opinion on how it's executed, and you give a kind of, you know,
pass fail,
right. Basically, this is recommend
worth
your,
this
or no.
Is, yeah, this is worth your time to continue to look at or not to look at, right?
Yes. So,
yeah. Okay. And so you, when you got that job, when you were interning, how many scripts were you reading per week or per day? Like, what was it? Lord. What was it at?
Every day, probably at least 4 or 5.
Oh, wow.
You imagine that, Robbie? That's your job. 4 or 5 scripts a day that you're reading through. Oh, my God. How many interns were there doing this besides you at the time?
Then? Well, when I was initially interning, I think there were 2 of us.
Yeah.
But then when I became the development assistant, I believe it was just me.
Okay. And it was just you doing that.
Yeah. But I mean, talk about grad school. I mean, I got to read and analyze hundreds and hundreds of screenplays. It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Catherine Bigelow too. That's
with Catherine Bigelow who got all the best stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. So you saw everything, which is
amazing.
I saw
everything.
That was a real education. You couldn't have even paid for that.
Absolutely.
Am I right? I mean, it was more valuable than getting any type of graduate degree at any film school.
Absolutely.
For you being right there next to Catherine Bigelow and then plucked out of internship into paid assistant job, which is fabulous.
Yeah.
How long did you spend doing that for? How many years was that?
I probably spent about 1.5 years with her.
Okay.
And during that time is when I decided that I was going to write.
And so
I was working on my own stuff, and I was working on a screenplay, and I wrote a couple of really bad screenplays, action screenplays, which were just terrible. But then I actually went to a convention where they were talking about, how to submit to a certain franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And they would read any script that you sent in. And I was like, well, I could do that.
Yeah.
So I wrote a script and I sent it in. And that's what kind of got me in thinking, television, I could do that. I love television. I especially like sci-fi. I could do that.
Right.
And that's literally how I got my foot in the door.
Wow. Yeah,
it's so interesting because Bigelow was so important in your life because Bigelow was the point in your life you realized you did not want to be a film director. You saw what it was like on set with assisting her. And then after reading script after script, and a lot of them very substandard quality scripts, you realize, hey, I could probably throw my lot into this. Game, and that's how your career started. That's really interesting.
Wow.
So what does this say, ladies and gentlemen, and other people out there, other orientation people? This means that interning or having an internship can lead to great, great things, especially in Hollywood.
You have to be able and willing to work for free for a while.
Yes.
Most interns are not paid.
That's right.
So you have to be able to afford to not get paid for a while, and that's a big stumbling block.
That's a big stumbling block. That's tough.
Because you got to build up savings.
I have a question for you. Like, so you were working, you got this amazing job, which was in the industry with Catherine Bigelow. And while you were doing that job, you were working on your own creative projects, writing and things on the side. How do you balance? Like for me, there's sort of structural discipline to my day if I'm trying to be efficient and productive. I have a structure. Like here's my schedule, my calendar. Here's how I'm spending my time. There's a time management thread. And then there's kind of a creative thread. How do you balance that when you, because a lot of people that listen to our show, like they have day jobs, but they want to be creative. Like, how did you balance your day job and being creative and being productive like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, I wasn't very closely supervised. Again, my boss was off directing and, you know, was really consumed with that. And so I basically sat in an office by myself so I could create my own schedule. And what I would do is I'd spend the first 2 hours of the day, you know, when I got in, you know, I'd get there at 9 o'clock and I'd spend till 11 writing on my own stuff.
Right.
And then I'd spend the rest of the day doing coverage.
Right.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah. If you are able to manage your time and get your job done responsibly, your day job done responsibly in less than the time allotted, then to spend some of the time on your own thing makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I was really lucky to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Can I ask a little bit about your creative process in terms of when you decide to write about something? Is it something that you're out and about and you see something, or you see an interaction, or you read about something and you're thinking, hey, this would be a great idea to sort of extrapolate and get a little bit into it, you know, pull it out into something bigger and better? Like, how do you do that as a writer, just to get your creative process?
I'm a big outliner. And certainly TV, you know, working for TV really promotes that, because you absolutely have to do an outline. But that suited me pretty well. I mean, I still work with, like, you know, index cards that I, you know, tape up on my wall, you know, move around scenes and stuff like that. So these days, like, if I get an idea, first I have to figure out where I want to put it. Does it seem like a movie? Does it seem like a series? Right now I'm writing a graphic novel. I've written some short stories. Yeah. So I kind of have to see what scale it kind of feels like to me.
Right.
And then, you know, kind of fit it into that format. You know, is it going to be a pilot script? Is it going to be, you know, three act structure, that sort of thing? Mm-hmm. And like I said, and then I outline the whole thing before I start writing.
Do you use specific writing software when you write?
I use Final Draft.
Final Draft. Would you say that is the main program that most writers use in Hollywood?
It is. And that's actually why I use it, because, you know, like I wrote a couple episodes for the TV show Pandora, and they used Final Draft. And so, you know, if I'm sending them files and stuff, I had to send them you know, with that program.
Gotcha. It just makes more sense.
What did you use back on that sci-fi show that we worked on? Because Final Draft might have been around.
I think it was like a.
It was around then, guys. I know it was around.
But it was very early.
I have a
it was
copy
definitely
of it
not,
back then.
Definitely not the standard. Like, there were three or four or five different ways that people wrote programs. People used, and some people just used a template on, like, Microsoft Word.
I think that's what we did.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I think that's what Brandon did. But I know the Final Draft has been around for a long time, for sure.
But it wasn't.
You don't think it was, like, around huge in the 90s? I thought it was that everyone used it in the 90s too.
It was up and coming, but I don't think it was a lot of templates on Microsoft Word, because like Lisa said, you had to be able to share that file with the whole staff. Yeah. And with your script coordinator and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so it had to be a file that everyone could deal with. And if it was, if somebody was working on Final Draft and somebody else was working on Word Perfect, or I don't know, you know, whatever the other ones were.
Right.
You'd have all these different files that couldn't talk to each other.
That weren't compatible.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, Final Draft is it now. If it wasn't, if it wasn't it back in the 90s, it is the end all be all for the most part.
Yes, it is.
Right. Okay.
What do you think about, I have a creative process question.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on collaboration versus independent work?
Good question.
I like both. I mean, I really enjoy the writer's room of television. Assuming that you're working with good people, you know, it's not one of those toxic environments that you read about and burn it down.
Yeah.
But if it's a good, positive environment, the way it was when I was on the franchise show, it was really positive. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
It was just like, you know, bouncing around ideas and, ooh, how about this? And, oh, and then we could do it that way. And then this other thing.
Yeah.
And that it was a blast. So that
it sounded that sounds fun to me, actually. A lot of fun, right?
It's totally fun. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, obviously when I wasn't working on a show, I would be, you know, working by myself.
Yeah.
But I actually have a writing partner that I do work with sometimes, and we're both writing the graphic novel together.
Okay. So how does that work then? When you have a writing partner, do you guys say, I'll take this block of scenes, you take this block of scenes, or do you go both work on the same scenes?
No, we broke it down together, you know, we down into, you know, an outline.
Yep.
And then, I'd be like, okay, you take, you know, this sequence, and then I'll take this sequence, and then we kind of swap it and give each other notes.
Nice.
And, you know, kind of meld it into one voice.
Yeah. And that works pretty well, too.
It does with this writing partner that I'm working with. Yeah. I mean, obviously it has to be the right person. Mm-hmm. But I've known him for like 20 years.
Oh,
and he's one of my best friends. And so we really function well as a writing team.
Did he that's write great. On the franchise that we all worked on? Did he?
No, but that's when we met.
Oh, you met,
you met around
that.
The same time.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
Fabulous.
Yeah. This, this episode that I wrote on this other show, this show I did this last year, I co-wrote it with the creator of the show. Oh, and so we did the whole, you know, the room broke the episode and was part of that. And then he and I went through and sort of wrote the outline collaboratively, very much kind of, we both worked on outline points, put it in our words, and then combined our documents a bit. Mm-hmm. Worked very, and then he said, I'm going to take the first three acts and you take the last three acts. I'll talk to you in a week or two. So we sort of did our separate work, and then we traded documents. Mm-hmm. And then we worked, you know, I polished and made changes, and then we started sort of putting it into collaboration. But there was a point where he had three acts and he was working very independently, and I had three acts and I was working very independently.
How was that?
It was great. I love the process. He's a very experienced showrunner. Chris Sheridan is his name. He's written on a ton of comedies and lots of shows. And he's very good at making the process pleasant and fun and creative, you know, and positive feedback. And so, and making it feel safe. So it was
the
great.
Best showrunners do that. Yeah. They really make you feel like you can volunteer a really stupid idea and you're not going to get like made fun of or laughed at about it. You know, that it's okay. Well, that doesn't work. Let's think of something else.
Yeah.
You know, and you can feel safe.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very good at that. I've worked on, I haven't written obviously nearly as much as you. That was not my main job, but I've written some other development things that I've sold with some other writers and things like that. Anyway, my point is, I've also been in writing rooms like comedy rooms, about like dramas are so much easier and tend to be much more supportive. Yeah. Comedy rooms, like the writing room in a comedy, it is cutthroat. Yeah. Like talk about not feeling safe. Oh. Yeah. The, you know, trying to beat everybody's joke and, oh, that's your joke. Oh yeah. Well, what about,
that's,
you know,
very
they're just
competitive.
Like, it's very competitive.
I don't know if I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be very cutthroat.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Lisa, have you been keeping up to date with Delta Flyer episodes? Have you been hearing them?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so
good.
I just want to say I'm so proud of Robbie, because in our season 8 storylines that he came up with, I was very impressed. I really was. I was
that was some good stuff.
My God, he came up with some awesome storylines that would have been super cool. And it just shows to show you, this could be a career that you could segue to. You don't have to direct anymore.
I'm heading to retirement. No, thanks.
All right, fine.
But I like the collaboration. I that's why I asked the question, because as a actor and then as a director, there's so much collaboration in both of those jobs. Whereas writing for me was always a struggle, even before, you know, years ago, because it was so independent for me.
Yeah.
And I just found that to be tough to motivate myself to. I like bouncing ideas. I like working with actors as a director and having their best ideas, you know, on the day. And how can we make that work? And how can I put that in my plan? And, you know,
Yeah.
I have one last question for you before we let you go. What was your role in your family growing up? How would you describe your role?
There you go.
Well, I was an only child.
Uh-huh.
And so I was kind of like a little adult. You know, I would always be, you know, sitting in the dining room with the adults.
Uh-huh.
And my parents had friends over, you know, that I would go and hang out with them.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, one of those eternally 40-year-old kids.
You were mature beyond your years.
So if you were at a, like a family, you know, holiday function or something, and there were a lot of other kids there, you would tend to gravitate towards the adult table and not the kids.
More often, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, yeah. Boy. Yeah.
Yeah, I asked that because I just wonder, how do you think that translated, your role in your family translated into your role as a writer? Like,
well, I think being an only child really had more to do with it because I, you know, had to entertain myself.
Yeah, you had to create your own world.
So I would read a lot.
Yeah.
You know, watch TV and watch movies. And then even when I would hang out with my friends, we would make up stories together.
Right.
You know, we write plays together and wrote a version of Little Women, if I recall, performed it for our enchanted
neighborhood families. Yes. Of course. Yes. Oh, yes. It was the greatest play ever written. Yes. I'm sure.
I think basically being on my own and kind of living in my own head, you know, led me more toward writing.
I wonder if they did a survey on that. Writers that were only children that were you know, raised as without any siblings. Is that the, you know, the fact that pushed them into writing? Who knows?
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me either. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, sure.
Yeah, on the Delta Flyers. And for all of you Patreon patrons, please stay tuned. We still have more Lisa Klink with us. We're going to answer some more questions with her. So stay tuned, Patreon patrons. For the rest of you, we will see you next week. Thank you.